Before we jump into today's episode, I have some exciting news to share with you. One of the questions I get asked all the time is, do you have any tips to help our team while we're conducting our equity audits? Well, now I do. Get my brand new ebook, 3 Essential Questions Every Equity Team Must Ask to Conduct Equity Audits That Make Real Change. It's your team's blueprint for action. Plus, the book comes with a cheat sheet guide at the end that can help your team use it to support your work. As I've been sharing it with folks, they've asked, well, is it $14.99 or is it $9.99? And you know what? I'm making it absolutely free. That's right. I just want to get this information into the hands of the people who need it for absolutely free. To get your free copy, all you need to do is to go to equityaudits.com/ebook. That's equityaudits with an S.com/ebook. Enter your name and your best email address, and I'll send it to you right away. So grab your free copy now. All right, on to today's episode. Have you ever wondered from people who actually do critical race theory what it really is? Or have you ever wondered, what does critical race theory have to do with education? And why has it gained so much attention over the last few years? Well, if you've answered yes to any of these questions, then you are in the right place. Hi, I'm Dr. Terrence L. Green. I'm a tenured professor, and I've helped to prepare hundreds of racially just and anti-racist school leaders, and I want to help you. That's why I created this podcast, to provide you and your team with real-world insights and practices that work so that you can collectively build racially just schools. On today's episode, I had the honor of speaking to Dr. Adrian Dixon, who is the executive director of the Education and Civil Rights Initiative and a professor of educational leadership studies at the University of Kentucky. Her research primarily focuses on how race, class, and gender intersect and impact educational equity in urban school settings. Dr. Dixon is one of the leading scholars globally on critical race theory in education. Dr. Dixon is a recipient of the Derrick Bell Legacy Award from the Critical Race Studies in Education Association. She's received numerous of other rewards and is a former middle school teacher, and she holds a PhD from the University of Wisconsin at Madison in curriculum and instruction. During our conversation, we talk about the context in which critical race theory emerges. We also spend some time talking about what critical race theory is not and what it is. And Dr. Dixon shares with us the differences between critical race theory in legal studies and then critical race theory in education. Finally, we spend some time talking about how people, practitioners, can anchor their work in critical race theory perspectives and what that may look like in schools. We talk about this and so, so much more. I'm super excited for you to hear this conversation. And if you're ready to get into today's episode, we will in 1 second. But first, I have a special announcer.
Welcome to the Racially Just Schools podcast with your host, Dr. Terrence L. Green. He's my daddy and he's the best.
Let's go.
You're listening to the Racially Just Schools podcast, the show that provides resources to help you and your team build racially just schools.
Welcome to the Racially Just Schools podcast. My name is Terrence L. Green, and I am your host. And yo, hey, y'all are in for an amazing episode today because we have one of the most profound scholars, I would dare say, in the world around critical race theory in education. I will say that. You might not say it, but I'm saying it. And so we'd like to welcome Dr. Adrian Dixon to the Racially Just Schools podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm so excited.
I am so excited. Super excited to talk to you today, given everything that's going on in education and in the world and given your expertise and background. One of the things I'm excited to just jump in and talk to you about is critical race theory, but specifically critical race theory in education. But before we even kind of get into that, I think it's important for people to understand context, right? Because these theories, they emerge racial, political, and a social context. And so could you first kind of lay some groundwork for folks around what is the context in which critical race theory emerges in critical race theory within the field of education?
Yeah. So I think it's really interesting because, you know, history repeats itself. So critical race theory as a field emerged after the Brown decision, and probably Derrick Bell would say it started. The Brown decision certainly was a catalyst in that people had a lot of hopes and dreams for the Brown decision, right? I mean, for in education for us, it was iconic. It changed. It changed what it meant to create schools that were supposedly accessible initially to students based on race, but then it grew, right? So a number of groups have used Brown as their foundation for advocating for access and equity and inclusion. And so the Brown decision was a catalytic decision, but also kind of what happened after Brown and the kind of sweeping changes that folks had hoped both within the education realm, but just socially, you know, people just dreamed that the U.S. would be this place that we all hoped it would always be. It would live up to its kind of rhetoric and the myths of a fully democratic country. And what legal scholars soon found is that actually the freedoms and the equity that we had hoped would happen because of Brown and the decisions that came after Brown that were influenced by Brown, so the Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act, all came after the Brown. So they after the Brown decision, so we just didn't see that. And in fact, that because we didn't see sweeping changes in terms of educational equity and desegregation. We didn't see sweeping changes in employment and college admissions and access to housing. Like we didn't see just the kind of sweeping changes that we thought that in some ways they started to question the role of the law in in maintaining systems of what they would call subordination, that because of how U.S. jurisprudence kind of operates and the function of the way that it operates, the way it's structured, is that there are opportunities to embed inequality within the law. And so what appears to be what appears to be equity actually just reinforces inequality and then makes inequality legal. And so the law, U.S. jurisprudence, is often a tool that helps to maintain and structure and build, if we use that metaphor all the way through, build inequality and inequity. And so that's kind of how critical race theory came out of it. So Derrick Bell, almost all of them, Derrick Bell, Mari Matsuda, Charles Lawrence, James Callmore, Richard Delgado, they were all civil rights lawyers and lawyers that looked at anti-discrimination law, Gary Peller and Neil Gotanda. And what they found is that, again, that there was this kind of disappointment. And skepticism that using the law would eradicate these issues that have not been eradicated because of law. So that's the kind of context is that where folks were like, oh no, it's just class. That was our critical legal scholars that really the law helps to maintain class divisions. And they, you know, wanted to look at that. And then they being Derrick Bell and Kimberly Crenshaw and realized that there was a limitation in this kind of class only critique, that the U.S. jurisprudence, yes, in some ways was very much implicated in class divisions, but it didn't explain, a class analysis didn't explain why these inequalities seem to impact people of color more profoundly than whites and more and disproportionately to whites. And so that kind of emerged in this kind of criticism. Critical race theory was a criticism of the law and how anti-discrimination laws, civil rights laws were just not going to ever get us where we thought they were going to get to because there was a refusal to engage in a examination of racial disparities. because the premise is that the law, right, law is blind. The justice is blind. And so it doesn't matter who you are. And they were saying, oh, it absolutely matters who you are. And it certainly matters if you ain't white. That's the context of critical race theory.
Wow, that is rich. That is so rich. And this, I'm glad you're on here talking about this, because you situate CRT as a response to Brown. And I think a lot of people forget that Derrick Bell tried numerous school desegregation cases. Yes, he had been trying them for decades, right? And so
Derrick Bell understood the educational context as it pertained to race. But the interesting thing is that the introduction of critical race theory in education, it doesn't come via Derrick Bell, right? It comes by Dr. Gloria Lassen-Billings and Dr. Bill Tate. So could you talk to me and talk to us about the context in which critical race theory in education specifically starts to emerge?
And so, you know, Gloria and Bill pick up this analysis because similarly in education, as you know, we have historically talked, it's just recently when we started to talk about racial disparities in education as a function of racism. It was, we would see racial disparities and we'd say it was just, you know, we'd analyze it from these large data sets and we put in a variable, right? We want to understand SAT scores. We're going to throw in some Black kids. We're going to throw in some Asian kids and we're going to run these ANOVAs. And then it just so happens that there is a race effect, but that's just one variable. Let's take that out and let's throw mother's education in. Well, what do these mothers look like, right? So they argued that the racial disparities that we saw in education around admissions, around high school graduation, discipline, that those, there are racial disparities, and they weren't just a variable. There actually is something there, and there's something happening that, even I'll say to the chagrin of my colleagues who do critical quantitative work, that we can't see just with the numbers. We need to understand more at the phenomenological level. What's happening in schools? What does the leadership look like? What's happening in terms of the pedagogical practices that teachers engage in? What's happening curricularly? What's happening in terms of policies? That we need to kind of take a closer look. And that's what they were arguing, that this, that these disparities don't exist just because there are more Black people in urban schools, that there's something happening that is causing this. And it aligns with the long history of racial subordination that was baked into public schools from the very beginning. So that's the context of critical race theory in education.
There is this very rich legal history in which CRT emerges. Could you talk a little bit about the importance of going back to the legal scholarship? Because I think a lot of times people will enter into this conversation in 95, which is critically important.
Right.
But even, I still call it Dr. Lassen-Billings, but even Gloria will say her and Bill Tate spent time at the Wisconsin School of Law Library reading the legal literature. So could you talk to the importance of people reading the legal scholarship as they enter into this work?
Yeah. And I'll say full disclosure, my dad was a lawyer who wanted me to be a lawyer. So I'm a lawyer in my mind. I group around and just hearing him argue the law with my sister's godfather, who was a judge, actually. And so it was fascinating to, again, think of the law as a strategy, as a tool that is very important in it structures all of our lives. And we play everything out in the courts. And so why is it important to read the law? Not because the law is infallible, but because literally everything that we can think of has been a decision, is the result of a legal decision and a legal maneuvering. And somebody has said that there is a legal question here that we need a court to answer. And it's, you know, from everything we can think of, kids and bilingual education, that you know, the prevailing wisdom was we just gonna keep talking to them in English and eventually they'll pick it up. And people were saying, well, no, we need you to, we can't. So there was the, that was the, right? That was the, was it the law decision? That was the, you know, people were arguing that you need to teach my child in their first language. So there was a legal, there was an issue and people were like, this is a legal question and we need the court to answer it. The court is not equipped to answer a question about pedagogy. The court can just say whether this is fair or not fair. And they will set, based on the decision, they will, you know, set a law. So it's important for those of us in education because almost literally everything we do has been decided by a court. Everything, right? Whether we can talk to somebody in the hallway about a kid's performance on a test. FERPA, hello, right? So that's a legal decision, right? Posting now, we can't even post grades. Remember back in the day, you could post people's grades on the boards. You can't do that. Or have a box outside your door as a professor. I'll put your papers in a bin outside my door and you can pick up. No, you can't. Not with my grade on it. That's a violation of FERPA. Why? Because somebody filed a lawsuit. So we can't then understand what are the legal implications and what are the racial implications of these court decisions. Because remember, the U.S. kind of common sense about the law is that the law, justice is blind. So the law is not going to ever purposely recognize, that's been the contention, is will the law, will U.S. jurisprudence be sensitive to racial, the nuances of race and racial, can they, and that's the argument of critical race theorists, is that can the law specifically take up race? And so far, in some ways, they've been reluctant to, and in other ways, they've reinforced racial disparities, right? So even who could be called white, the court was like, well, white is what the average person says is white. And well, at that time, the average person was white, and they were saying, we ain't white. So, you know, how can that be the standard? Because there were people who were saying, well, look, my skin is light. Why can't I be white? Because the average person ain't going to say you white. Wait, what? So, you know, so that's why we argue that you need to go back to, you need to look at legal cases because the courts in the U.S. and their, you know, various stages of courts, they structure our lives in really important ways. And for, again, for those of us in education, it's incredibly important. We're almost straitjacketed by the law, right? So, and you know this as a school leader, you know, working with school leaders, you are always, as school leaders, always operating in a place of compliance.
Oh, that's really good. That's really, really rich. You know, one of the things as critical race theory has, you know, entered into mainstream popular discourse, folks have, it's in many ways become an empty signifier. It's everything and it's nothing all at the same time. And so somebody, you know, had something around diversity or they had a picture of Martin Luther King and they say, oh, that's critical race theory.
Right. Right?
Before we kind of talk about what critical race theory is theoretically and how it's taken up, could you kind of like dispel some of the myths about what critical race theory is not?
Yeah. So critical race theory is not teaching about white supremacy. It's not culturally relevant pedagogy. It's not DEI, quote unquote, work. So it's not any of those things. But we hope it can inform those things, right? It can make us understand how white supremacy manifests in school or in our decision making around policy. But it's not white supremacy is a thing that exists on its own, regardless of critical race theorists weren't the first ones to call white supremacy out that existed before us. You know, culturally relevant pedagogy. Gloria at the time hadn't even started writing about critical race theory when she wrote Dreamkeepers. Critical race theory came after Dreamkeepers. So to conflate the two is just, you know, so it's not that. It's not saying white folks or black folks or it's not being woke. You know, those it's not any of those things, but it's been lumped into all of it.
And thinking about kind of like bringing folks into an empirical, a theoretical understanding of critical race theory and critical race theory in education, how would you just start to describe it and even thinking about some of the tenets that make up what CRT is?
Yeah. Well, I think of CRT in terms of how it helps us name practices and policies and processes that make racial subordination and disparity, racial disparities, a kind of common sense reflection of that's just the way it is, right? So we will say, we'll use again, mother's education level and see that kids, you know, don't do well on AP or don't take AP scores or don't graduate because of mother's education level. And that just becomes a, oh, you know, that's just how it is. That I think, again, from a critical race theory analysis, is a common sense way of accepting racial subordination. And so if we looked more closely at how does mother's education level, when teachers see that data, and this has happened to me as a mother, and in particular in Madison, here I was a PhD student at the University of Wisconsin, and all teachers saw was were my children's profile, Black boys, single mother, free and reduced lunch. They didn't see my education level. They just saw that profile and made assumptions about my education level. And I actually had teachers ask, you know, did the boys ever go to the doctor? I was like, why do you think they're like, you know, 7 years old? But I literally could not have registered them in school without vaccination. So they had to see somebody like, what are we doing? So we, you know, it's that, again, that is a racist ideology to operate from. And children have to go to school and sit in classrooms with people who hold these racist ideologies that on paper just look neutral, right? Because we baked into our research, have looked at kids who don't do well, tend to be from, you know, single parent families, female headed families, you know, et cetera. And so I think that critical race theory helps us have a sharper analysis about those common sense things, those things that we take for granted, how they are a reflection of racist ideologies, white supremacist ideologies that then inform, shape, and impact opportunity, access, and even outcomes. So if, you know, who are you going to choose to represent the school? Who gets to go to AP? If you have assumed that because of this kid's mother's background, they'll never do well, you know, they're bearing that cross that has very little to do with what they can actually do and any basis in truth, right? It's just a correlation, but we've made these correlations causal, and kids bear the brunt of these, again, these assumptions and these ideologies that I would argue are racist and white supremacists. And CRT is a way of helping us kind of look more closely at that and name it.
And thinking about, that's good. And thinking about, you know, the naming of it, and you mentioned school leaders, and there are a lot of school leaders, school board members who listen to the podcast, teachers who are in schools and they're under compliance and they're living with the everyday realities of race and racism and what it means in schools. And so I'm curious, what might you offer to teachers, to school leaders, to people who are working in schools within this context or environment of this anti-critical race theory context in which they work, but they still want to maintain the criticality of their work. They still want to maintain the analysis that they have. What might you offer to how they might move and position and maneuver within this context?
Yeah. Well, I do think that people have to think about their biases. I think we have to confront those constantly and all the time. So, you know, you do professional development, we do professional development with teachers, and folks think they just take a session and they're done. And it's like, no, this is ongoing. Yeah. Always, you know, you always have to confront, what am I doing? But again, what is the kind of common sense way that I think about this that has now positioned a child as less than? that I think about free and reduced lunch and I'm like, oh yeah, those kids on free and reduced lunch. That's a bias that I hold. And that kid is held responsible. Some they have no control over, right? They're a child. They don't have any control over that. And in many ways, neither do their parents. So I think that we say reflection, but I really do think that's important. I don't know how we operationalize it within the context of a school. You know, we've asked leaders to keep journals, reflection journals. You know, ain't nobody going to do that. Like, it's just not. They're going to do it during the session. And then when you leave, that's it, right? So how do you bake that into the practice and hold up a mirror, right? I think my hope would be that that's what the leader starts the day out with. Like, what's our bias today? This is what we got to work on. You know, this is our, like, that we could give schools and teachers time to start their day thinking about the little people who are coming into their room or the big people that are coming into their room every day. Like, that's how we start our day. Let me get myself centered. Let me get myself together. And let's go from there. I would hope that, you know, as districts set policies, that they would do the same thing. How are we structuring this so that people can't be fully included? Or that we've made some assumptions about what they can and cannot do. And I don't think that gets you in trouble to think about people, to think about how I use the term stuck. Where do I get stuck? You know, I get stuck. I'm an English speaker. I grew up in the United States. I don't have to worry about citizenship. Mostly I don't have to worry about citizenship. You know, I mean, I grew up knowing that I'm an American citizen. And so ain't nobody coming to snatch me out of my house and send me back somewhere because this is where I am. I don't have to think about when I go anywhere that it won't be in a language that I speak. I get stuck around bilingualism, right? I get stuck around physical accessing buildings. I mean, more so I'm thinking about it now because I have an injury in my back. So I'm like, damn it, all these damn stairs, they don't have a ramp or there's no elevator. But I didn't have to think about that until it impacted me, right? So where do I get stuck? I get stuck around those things. And so I ask teachers and school leaders when I work with them to think about where do you get stuck? And how do we make that transparent in our work so that we can get unstuck? Oh, man, I don't ever think about this. I need to start thinking about it. And, so that's how I would hope it would be operationalized. And again, you don't even have to call it critical race theory, but you are engaged in a critical thought about how families and how children can't fully participate and be present in the school.
Oh, that's powerful. That is powerful. Like, where do you get stuck is a powerful question that folks who are engaging the podcast can constantly come back to. And I think that opens up a lot of possibilities and opportunities to think radically differently about the work that you're engaged in. So thank you for sharing that. When I think about where do people get stuck, and I'm thinking coming back to the conversation we just had previously about critical race theory, one of the places people have gotten stuck, and in fact I got stuck here in critical race theory. I remember Kevin and Shamika, we argued to 2:00 in the morning over Eric Bell's notion of racial realism. And mm-hmm. A lot of people get stuck there because they feel like it's defeatism, is like it's giving up, it's like totalizing. And you know, the faith tradition we come from, I liken it to that in my own, like there ain't nothing I can do. You know what I'm saying? Like, and so that creates a position for me to look for someone that's higher, that is greater. And so it's not to me a defeat to realize that in and of myself, I'm insufficient. It actually opens up new possibilities to a whole new world and to a whole new level of existence. But could you talk about racial realism?
Yeah.
And Bell's analysis of that and the importance of it as we work around race, particularly critical race theory in education.
This might be not a full, I'm gonna say this is a half-baked kind of metaphor, but I think about it as a person of faith. Because Derrick Bell was deeply, deeply in the word.
Yes.
You know, he if you read any of his work, and actually one of his books, his book about his life, I used to use it with my research class. I'm blanking on the title, but anyway, he was a person of faith, and he structured all of his writing around the word. He always had a word, right? And so I'm going to say this just as a reality. We're all going to die. Mm. We're all going to die. Mm. We know that to be true. Yep. And so how do you live your life knowing that it's going to come to an end one day? Do you just wake up and like, well, what's the point? Because I'm going to die. We're all going to die at some point. Mm. But do we live trying to do the best that we can do to make while we're here a good place for us to thrive, to be happy, to support people? You know, how are you going to live that life, right? Similarly, and again, I'm not going to say racism is a death, but in some ways it is. It's so with racial realism, it's there. And so how do we live? They say you got to leave them with hope, right? Like, where that you got, what's the good news, right? At the end, you're going to let, we name all this stuff, but the good news is, the good news with racial realism is that we can still fight. Mm. Racism, and that's so that, you know, for Derrick Bell, the racism is permanent. It's going to be here. Death is coming. Mm. All of us going to go. Mm. But how do we live? How do we live? And so with racial realism in the U.S., we have to accept this is, it is what it is. People are like, it ain't, it's been here. It's always been here. Racism has always been a part of the U.S. Hating Black people has always been a part of the U.S. Subordinating Black people, subordinating anyone who is not white. We think about the history of the Chinese, the history of Native Americans, the land taken from Latinos. Taking, stealing, mistreating is deeply embedded. It's in the fabric of the U.S. Does that make the U.S. a terrible place? I'm not going to make a comment about that because that's, but that's, this is where we are. So I wake up every day angry and mad that I live in the U.S. and I'm just going to be mad, blah, blah, blah. Or the good news is I can try to do what I can to make this a better place for whoever I encounter, particularly people who are Black, right? We can fight. We don't have to accept that because there's racism, I'm always going to be mistreated. No, I'm not. I'm going to fight this thing. Mm. I know I'm going to die. Does that mean, you know, again, I'm just going to eat Twinkies and donuts all day long and just speed up the process? No, I'm going to try to, you know, I'm going to try to do this thing as best I can. So I think that's what racial realism is. It's here. It's always been here. And the indication is after 300 years, it ain't going nowhere. So what do we do while we're here? And he would even say with enslaved Africans, like that was the condition that they were in, but they knew that somehow the good news is it ain't always going to be this way. And people fought. What we don't know, what we don't do, what we, and this is purposeful, right? This, we know that it was intentional not to talk about slave revolts because we didn't want to give nobody, they didn't want to give people any idea that you could fight this thing. Mm. Slaves didn't just accept the condition, they fought it. So we don't have to accept the condition of racism, we can always fight it, but we recognize that it's here.
That's good. That's good, right? That there go the word right there. Oh, preach me in.
Come on now.
What were you about to say?
I say, yeah, that ghost gets on you. You know, you got.
No, that is so good. That is so good. Yeah. And I think, again, people get stuck there because they think it means that you just, you don't fight, you don't resist. And so that makes me wonder, could you talk a little bit about critical race praxis? Yeah. Like, is a praxis to this? Like, what were scholars thinking about? How does that unfold? How does that come into the landscape as we think about CRT, CRT and education?
Yeah. So the praxis piece is, again, I'm going to go back to Derrick Bell. The word, you know, being flesh, it just doesn't live in the Bible, right? It doesn't live in our articles that kind of I think if we look at the examples of CRT scholars, and Derrick Bell is probably the most profound, and prolific, that he lived out his politics. You know, he, and I think there was a, if we, again, to use him as an example, and he's written about this, that there was a deep sense of contrition that he had because he felt that he was complicit in a, in the Brown decision that did, that was meaningless, that didn't do for Black people what they had hoped, because he wrote this article, Serving Two Masters, and that, it, again, you know, he's profoundly a believer, and he wasn't serving his people. He was serving a different agenda that had nothing to do with the people. And the people didn't want Brown. They didn't want Brown as it manifested. They knew, they lived in the South. They knew how hateful and violent white people were to them. They're like, I ain't trying to send my child to a school. These attitudes and beliefs about what about Black people are a part of who they are and what they believe about us. They're not going to change because the court said schools need to be desegregated. Why would I put my child through that? Just give me what I put into it. Just make sure that I get what's equal. And he didn't do that, right? He took their stories and they gave them Brown. And so he felt deeply, again, guilty about that. And so as a result, I think he wanted to work to undo that. But also just a part of who he was someone who was active, who was a part of that. And so that's the critical race praxis piece is, it's not enough to just write about racial subordination. We have to act on how do we resist it? Mm-hmm. How do we, to the extent that we can make some movement, because it's we're not going to get rid of it. It's so deeply ingrained in what the U.S. is. But we can, again, how do we make this better? How do we push back? How do we fight? How do we dislodge to the extent that we can and make some movement? And so that's where I think the praxis is. And the praxis comes from being with the people. It's not, again, sitting in our offices writing articles. It's by those folks who are most deeply impacted by these decisions. And I think for Bell, as an example for us, is that he felt a responsibility to those, to the Black folks in the South who were his quote unquote clients that he didn't serve. I would encourage everybody to go back and read Serving Two Masters. It reminds me often of who is this work for, and who do we serve? Who do we serve? It's hard because we're in a university and the university has an agenda, and the agenda is to get recognition, to get grant money, blah, blah, blah. But does that serve the people? Mm. And who are you serving? Like, that's the, you know.
We've been talking about this activism and this praxis and the pushing back. And I know you've written about youth-led education activism, thinking about Black Lives Matter from not just a civil rights frame, which I think oftentimes, anytime Black people are resisting something, there is that theoretical archetype of civil rights. And so, could you talk about what we learned? Because I think this generation, there is a fearlessness, I think, that young people have today. And I feel like young people always have that, you know, but there's this fearlessness.
Yeah.
Go for it. What do we learn from critical race theory as we think about youth-led activism and education? And how might we start to think about creating and fostering the conditions
in
schools?
Yeah, I think that's a challenge, actually, for critical race theorists. And I think, and I said this to like colleagues who, when we think about activism, we think about marches in the street. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that that's the most effective way, but that's the only way that we've taught change is that people marched. And actually, that's not true. Marching, as I've learned, because I'm learning with colleagues who are organizers, that marches are a strategy, but that's not the only thing. And that young people have the energy and the vision that we often don't have, because they, you know, they can imagine something new because they don't necessarily know what's come before. Right. So they have hopes and desires and they have the energy and the boldness to ask for something else. You know, little kids, when we think about even young kids, they always ask for stuff. And I'm like, I ain't got money for that. But they, you know, they ask, they have the will and the desire to ask for it. They're like, I'm going to ask for it. You can tell me, but I'm going to ask for it. And so I think there is something. One of my colleagues, his name is Cedric Johnson, is that we have to be careful with romanticizing young people, because young people, again, want to ask. It's learning how to, and all of us have to learn how to, what's the strategy to get. And so I think critical race theory yet hasn't, I don't say everybody, I think Kim Crenshaw is an example of someone who has tried to enact change, and she does through her organization, the African American Policy Forum, and they do policy work, and she's tried to think about this across a number of domains, social media. She does a CRT summer school. And so that's important work. I think there's an organizing piece that we need to learn how to do, that we just, you know, we don't know enough about really the organizing that happened during the civil rights movement. We're just now learning about Bayard Rustin and Ella Baker. We don't know, you know, all the work that went into the organizing piece. So I think that's an understudied and under that we don't understand that work well enough yet.
Gotcha. That is powerful. What is the strategy to get? Woo! That is so good. Wow. That's powerful. Thank you. That is.
Thank you.
Something to reflect on. 30 seconds. I want to ask you just a series of quick questions as we conclude. Thank you so very much. I know we're already at time. But if there was a movie made about your life, who would you want to play you and why?
Who would I want to play me? Of course, I want Angela Bassett to play me. Now, she don't look nothing like me. But you talk about somebody who can act, I want her, because she going to act.
If you could only listen to music from three artists, they could be groups, solo, whatever. Who would those three be? And only three you can listen to for the rest of your life.
For the rest of my life, it would be Layla Hathaway. It would be Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. And it would be Mint Condition.
Awesome. Well, where can folks learn more about your work, things you're doing? How could they, you know, find out about that?
Just Google Scholar. That's how you can find
me. Gotcha. Yeah. Well, I want to say personally from the bottom of my heart, thank you so very much for breaking bread with me and for coming on the podcast. It has truly been an honor. I'm excited for folks to hear this. I know a lot of university folks listen to it, so this is something I'll be putting on my syllabi, and I would encourage, you know, university people put on their syllabus and practitioners. But thank you so very much for coming on. Really, really.
Thank you for having me. This is awesome.
Thank you. Got to come back now.
I will.
All right, y'all. Like Marty, like in the words of old Marty Marsh, see you when we see you. Peace.
Well, that is it, folks. Thank you so much for joining. I hope you enjoyed it, and I am so excited and really looking forward to our time together during future podcasts. What I need you to do is to please hit the subscribe button, share with a friend, and please leave a review. Love reviews. And if you want to hear more from me, you can head on over to www.raciallyjustschools.com. That is www.raciallyjustschools.com. When you join our community, I have a free video for you on three tips that will make your racial justice work better. And again, if you love the show, hit subscribe, rate it, and leave a review on iTunes. And until next time, peace.